Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Deborah Amos, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Asian Americans have long been considered a model minority. The product of rigorous tiger parents, they earn college degrees and the highest median income of any ethnic group, including whites. But my guest today, a Korean-American writer, sees big flaws with Asian values. He says the very skills that Asian parents instill in their children, humility, rote learning, hard work, may doom them to a mindset of subservience and middle management in the corporate world. This hour, On Point, Asian Americans and the Bamboo Ceiling. You can join the conversation. Are you the product of tiger parenting? Did it prepare you to succeed by your own measure in the world? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Wesley Yang, contributing editor to New York Magazine. His article last week was Paper Tigers, What Happens to All the Asian American Overachievers When the Test Taking Ends. It's linked on our website, onpointradio.org. Wesley Yang, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Deb.
I am going to quote from your piece. Here's what I sometimes suspect my face signifies to other Americans, an invisible person, barely distinguishable from a mass of faces that resemble it. And you go on to write, an icon of so much that the culture pretends to honor, but that it in fact patronizes and exploits. It's an angry, fascinating piece. What kind of reaction have you gotten?
I personally have gotten almost nothing but positive reactions.
And who writes you?
Asian people who identify with it. And there are a lot of people who Asian people identify with it. There's, of course, been a handful of bloggers and tweeters and other people on the internet who have real problems with it. And you know, I understand why they have problems with it.
You write about test cramming and home life, but then a revelation comes to you from a poet at Williams College, an Asian American. Smiling is the key to fitting in. Explain that.
Well, I mean, this is what he felt, right? Like, he felt that he came from a Chinese-American household where he was trained to meet certain social norms and expectations, and among those were a kind of like a self-effacement where you wouldn't be as facially expressive. And when he went to Williams College, leaving behind the kind of like ethnic subculture that he'd grown up in, he found himself to be a little socially out of place. And one of the things that he noticed was that his like preceptor, his freshman year, kept coming up to him and saying, you know, hey, man, are you okay? Is there something you want to talk about? And it became clear that, like, his ordinary sort of neutral facial expression was being interpreted by all the people around him as being kind of, like, disturbed or upset or depressed, when, in fact, it was just his ordinary Asian face.
And do you not think that people of other ethnic groups don't also have that dour face? I live in New York, and when you're walking down the street, everybody looks like that.
Lots of people do. It's true. But for whatever reason, when he was up at Williams College around prosperous white people who go to Williams College, his face was singled out as like his friends would say to him, hey, Dan, you know, it's kind of hard to tell what you're thinking. And I think this is like one of these weird kind of moments where like the racial micropolitics of everyday life like becomes revealed to you. And that was basically what my piece was about. It was about like the kind of like strange Asian baggage that like Asian people encounter over the course of their lives and whether or not that impinges on the actual outcomes of their life. And what I found was there is an argument that can be made, and there's a group of people who make it, that like these things are in some way related to this thing called the bamboo ceiling.
But and we'll get to that in a minute. What I understand from you writing about smiling was a revelation that this is a larger point, that there are cultural things that the majority culture learns, and you're arguing that Asian Americans don't. Sometimes they come, on the sports field, sometimes in the gym, but it's all these intangibles that tiger moms actually don't know anything about, and these
Sure.
are skills you have to have.
I mean, look, and if you're a first-generation immigrant from another country, why should you understand them? So, you know, I'm looking at, like, a specific, like, you know, first the children of first generations living in ethnic enclaves like Flushing and Bayside or Sunnyside in Brooklyn in a big city, who end up going to a school called Stuyvesant, which is like this elite public high school, where the kids have been 50% to 70% Asian at any given time. And where you simply, you know, there certainly are cross-racial friendships like there are at any other school, but there's like a large core of like Asian American kids who, you know, who fit the stereotype in the sense that, like, yes, there will be a large group of people sitting in the back writing down everything the teacher says, memorizing it, and not saying a word. Like, that is just cultural observation to say that that is there. And these are kids who went through that, who were living in that little ethnic bubble, and sort of halfway into their high school life, looked around, looked at the culture that they could see around them and said, you know, we're dissatisfied with this. Like, we are conscious of the fact that the way we're being socialized here is not going to be sufficient for the way we're going to have to be when we get out into the real world. And they were very open about the fact that, like, they understood this, they knew this, and they felt like that they were missing something.
The figures are telling. Asian Americans represent roughly 5% of the population, but only a fraction of the corporate officers, less than 1% of corporate board members, 2% of college presidents. Is that a bamboo ceiling, or is that simply a matter of a generation gap, that when Chinese come here, become Americans, that they are lower down on the socioeconomic scale and their kids move up, but it takes a couple of generations to get there?
The disappointment is relative to expectations that are raised by academic success. So if you have kids who've been number one and who've been trained to be number one throughout their entire formative years, it can be a real kind of shock of cold water to the face when they enter the corporate world and they discover that, like, the expectation that they're going to be number one is not true, and that, in fact, they're going to perform at lower than parity rather than sort of, like, you know, proportionate to their numbers. So there's certain areas of, like, the white-collar workforce where there are lots of Asians, and it turns out to be the case that they will do less than parity. And by this I mean there are more Asian-American associates at law firms. They're the most well-represented minority group at law firms, and they make partner at a rate lower than any other group, and this includes blacks and Hispanics. And so there are a lot of different ways to explain this. You can look at the culture. You can say, you know, something that I didn't emphasize that much but I think is just obvious is that, like, old, rich white people, some of whom are racist, like, continue to be in charge, right? Like, that's also just, like, part of the background, right? And then another part of the background is this cultural stuff, which you can never be so sure. And that's why Asian people are so interesting to study as an instance of how race functions today. Because we are sort of officially meritocratic, we are officially post-racial, people are not openly bigoted, and yet we arrive at these outcomes that are not really so different than if we continued to be openly bigoted. That's the fascination. And then we have to, like, answer this, like, wide-ranging inquiry, which Asian American individuals have to answer. Is it like, am I just a dweeb? Is there a racial problem here? Is it racism from without? Is it, like, a problem with the culture? And I think the answer is that it's a little bit of all. You can't know for sure. The only way you can measure the existence of the bamboo ceiling is to look at certain statistical irregularities or irregularities as they play themselves out over time.
As you might imagine, this is a very popular topic, and so we're getting lots of traffic on our website. And I want to read you something from Morgan, who has an adopted Asian American child. SATs need to be on average 140 points higher to compete with white college students. She asks, is there a place in American schools for simple average Asian Americans? Her adopted daughter was refused a math tutor because the teacher assumed the child was just lazy because all Asians are good at math, right? She says. But here's a point that I wanted to raise with you. She says Asian is such a broad brush. We're talking about Hmong, Vietnamese, Indian, Chinese, Korean, all these different cultures. Can you say that this bamboo ceiling is true for all of those people under that umbrella?
Okay, well, so here's the weird thing. We have this, like, model minority, right? And I was writing about the model minority. The model minority consists most, like, has a very specific demographic profile. It's mostly, like, people from, like, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and South Korea, like, who came here after 1970 when the United States started to, like, give priority in their visas to, like, people with technical and higher education, right? And so they had this specific idea of how they're supposed to raise and train their children. And then their children went out, and then they created this image that became, you know, like broadly popularized, like in a Time magazine story and so on and so forth. And then this kind of image of the Asian American overachiever like became predominant. That's what I was writing about because that's what like the readers of New York Magazine are interested in. A piece that like made all of like the important qualifications would include three qualifications for every assertion, and would have no flow. It would be like it would be an academic paper in an Asian American studies journal that nobody would read. So that's like a regrettable problem about the diversity of Asian America, because like even within New York, like the Chinese community is divided into like half of these like model minority people, and then like half people who like work in restaurants and or may or may not have papers and are members of the working class or lower who share most of like the pathologies of the urban poor. So that's like a real problem. But like as a feature writer for New York Magazine, it's not really my role to like solve that one.
So you just wanted to hit people between the eyes. Yeah.
Sure.
This is On Point. I'm Deborah Amos, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about Asian Americans and the specific challenges they face. My guest is Wesley Yang, contributing editor to New York Magazine. His cover story last week was Paper Tigers. It argues that the strict mentality of Asian parents, which helps Asian children succeed in school, actually hinders them in the real world. And it generated a lot of controversy in the Asian American community. Joining us now from New York is Jeffrey Yang, no relation to Wesley. He writes the Asian pop column for the San Francisco Chronicle and founded A Magazine, the largest Asian American magazine, when it was in circulation. He's editor of the comic book series Secret Identities, the Asian American superhero anthology. Jeff Yang, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you write about superheroes, which flies in the face of everything that Wesley is writing about. So you can be a superhero, you just can't be the head of a corporation.
I feel like everything I do flies in the face of somebody, I suppose. The anthology was really, in a way, not that dissimilar in some ways to what Wesley did in writing his story, in the sense that it is an anthology of exception. It's an anthology that looks at why there are so few superheroes in the comics, despite the fact there are so many Asian American superhero creators. And in that sense, I suppose, there's a bamboo ceiling or maybe a kryptonite ceiling for superheroes as well.
Well, so there are creators and they don't create people in their own image?
Well, you know, I think that's changed a lot. But historically, I mean, when you think about it, the pantheon of superheroes, the Supermans, Batmans, Wonder Womans, and so forth of the world were all created back in an era when heroism was effectively synonymous with a certain identity, a certain look. And as a result, I mean, you have essentially the equivalent of, I suppose, you know, what Wesley talks about in corporate America, an old boys network, except with capes and cowls. So it's much harder for people to create new characters that break through that, I suppose, in the modern era. And yet it's changed a lot.
Wesley, I wanted to come back to you a minute because we teed up the idea that you actually went to dinner with the biggest tiger mom in America. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that dinner. I can't imagine what you all talked about.
Well, you know, prior to while we were writing the piece, we're trying to, you know, I tried to interview her, but she was really busy, and so I wasn't able to get her. But she did, you know, as soon as she read it, she emailed me, and her email said, "Wow, great, we should go to dinner sometime." And it turned out that, and then she tweeted it and she put it on her Facebook, and it turned out that she was giving a speech that night for the Asian American Journalists Association, who then invited me to attend. I did attend, and then we went to we all went to dinner together. So me and Jeff, who I was meeting for the first time, and Amy, and then a lot of other Asian American journalists.
And
it was great.
Among the three of you, did you at some moment agree that tiger moms actually do good?
Well, you know, the reason one of the reasons I think that Amy liked my piece was I had a somewhat different reading of her book than other people, and it was not unsympathetic to her project, and ended up endorsing at least one aspect of it.
Which was?
So, I mean, look, her book in addition to celebrating the tiger mother, also provides all of the evidence you would need to undercut, undermine, and refute her own argument about tiger mothers. And this is something that a lot of people missed, because Amy Chua talks about how, you know, she made it through Harvard. She was at Yale Law School. And when she got to Yale Law School, what she discovered was that all she had done prior to then was learn how to, like, memorize things through this kind of brute force learning. And she wasn't naturally skeptical or inquiring. She didn't care about the rights of criminals. She didn't really want to be a law student, basically. And then she went on to corporate law, where she felt like, I think the quote is, like an imposter in a suit. So she's describing, like, a long period, like, in the wilderness that has a lot to do with, like, the worst of the outcomes that a tiger upbringing can provide you, because your parents kind of force you to do something that is prestigious when you don't really have your heart in it. And you're so focused on perfection and getting the right answers that you never discover what your actual passions are. And she portrays herself as precisely a person who went through this process. And yet, she still feels this, she doesn't want to repudiate her tiger upbringing. She doesn't want to repudiate her parents and say, you made me deficient in the ways that I needed to be. And of course, eventually she does, like, go on to be a good teacher and write best-selling books and find her passion in life. It takes a little bit longer, and I think this is a trajectory that a lot of Asian people who have some experience of being a paper tiger at some period in their life have to go through. But she also, like, you know, she's writing within a specific context where she's surrounded by these kind of New Haven liberals who are raising their children in a certain way. And so she becomes very, like, defensive about it. And the memoir is responding to that. So, like, a tiger upbringing or sort of being a strict Asian parent means something very different, like, at one end of the socioeconomic spectrum than it does at another. And, you know, this is something that, like, I think a lot of sort of non-Asian people didn't pick up on. It's something that I picked up on in the piece. And in the end, I reached the conclusion that even though, like, a lot of the kind of stereotypes and the racial sort of paranoia that got batted around in the wake of the Tiger Mother book, that there was something, like, really brash and really bold about her, and there is something very brash and bold about her that came through at the dinner as well. You know, there's something basically salutary about that. Hmm. And the fact that she tried to open, you know, this kind of gap in the culture where people could begin to think about Asian American issues and to think about Asian American people was good. And so I tried to open that breach a little bit more.
Well, we have plenty of calls, and we're going to go to Julie from Boston, Massachusetts. Julie?
Hi. How are you, everybody?
Good. You're on point.
Oh, thank you. I just want to say that I'm the first generation of Asian Americans. I could totally relate to the Tiger Mom book because I'm the perfect product of that. But bring the mentality and living in the U.S., that's difficult. And because we are trained not to be political in the work environment, and we are being assumed that you are smart and you get the most workload and that you make the most money in a group, but when there's a budget cut, you are the first one to go. And I find that I myself in that position a few years ago, and I found that later on some Asians and also, and that's very tough to adjust.
Jeffrey Yang, let me ask you this. There are plenty of Asian Americans who do succeed. There's mm-hmm. Asian Americans in Congress, the head of the Department of Energy, the guy who runs the best shoe site on the web. So somehow they got past what you all say is an innate sense of yourselves as non-complainers, hard workers, and not aggressive enough to get all the way to the top. So how do they do that?
Well, I mean, I certainly don't think that that is, in fact, innate. I think that one of the things which maybe is left out of the Tiger Mom dialogue is the fact that every action can create a reaction. And you do find plenty of people who have undergone some semblance of quote-unquote tiger upbringing who find that as an inspiration or a challenge that they overcome and overcome successfully. That, you know, to a certain extent, it's the subversion or the rebellion of Tiger Momism that leads them to become who they are ultimately. I mean, I certainly feel like I probably fall into that category. I think Wesley certainly does in his own assertions. And I actually believe that if you look beyond corporate America, if you look beyond kind of the establishmentarian areas of our society, what you'll see is a real efflorescence of creativity, innovation, and risk-taking among Asian Americans, many of whom did go through all the milestones of Tiger Mom identity, graduating from good schools, getting whatever grades and SATs, and then headed out and instead of actually working for corporate America or after working for corporate America for a time, left to launch their own enterprises. And it's that actually that I think is a little bit left out of the dialogue around Tiger Mom versus non-Tiger Mom. The fact that there are people out there who are perhaps taking a leave of absence from the attempts to push against the bamboo ceiling to do something entirely novel. And more of them, I think, every day.
I also wanted to ask both of you.
I didn't say that 0.0% of corporate officers were Asian. I said 0.3% were Asians. So, of course, yeah, there are people who, like, get through this stuff. And I think mostly these are people who, like, end up either evading the bamboo ceiling or very consciously sort of like becoming aware of like some of the issues that were raised in my article, like either through a process like conscious or unconscious, like they reshape themselves so that they do sort of fit the normative leadership culture.
And I wanted to ask both of you if you thought that this was particularly Asian American or simply immigrant culture. I certainly know Arab immigrants who make their kids study, who are Tiger Moms in all but name. And, you know, when you get here, America is a tough place to make it. And an immigrant parent understands that better than the kids.
You know, I think that's actually a terrific point, and it is one, in fact, that Amy Chua herself makes, that Tiger Moms, although they've been typified as, and she's the shorthand of Chinese mother or Asian mother, that Tiger Moms come in all stripes. And I think that the notion that even prior generations of immigrants, I think the model example of that's often used is Jewish Americans, for instance, of a prior generation, had similar kinds of values, similar kinds of attitudes towards parenting. And you had similar cycles of, you know, growth and rebellion and an interjection of persons into the larger frame of establishments like corporate America and like the Ivy League colleges and so forth that in some ways perhaps only took time to shift the stereotype from. And, you know, the fact is I don't know that that's not to a certain extent what's happening with Asian Americans, that I look at my own kids who are still very young and wonder whether my sort of hybrid parenting, my Prius parenting, Asian branded, made in America, isn't in some way giving them opportunities to stand on the shoulders of prior Tiger kids, myself included perhaps, to reach higher.
Oh.
You know, so the issue with Asian Americans is that they keep becoming like successive waves from those countries. So 2/3 of all Asian Americans are foreign born, and almost everyone here has arrived after the 1970s. So in 1970, when my brother was born, there were 38,000 Koreans, people of Korean descent, living in the United States, and there's a million now. So sure, of course. I mean, this is a part of it, but there are also like these specific dynamics that people experience, social dynamics that disfavor them in the workplace, that have to do with, and of course, it's not unique to Asian Americans. Anybody that comes from a culture more traditional, more authoritarian in the way sort of individuals relate to one another, in the relationship of like spontaneity to self-control, in the way you relate to authority, is going to have to go through an adjustment process. And my piece is about how Asian people are going through that adjustment process now.
We're talking about the Asian American community in the U.S. today. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now from Long Beach, California, is Gene Kahayan. He's a Filipino-American filmmaker, director of The Debut, a groundbreaking indie film about Filipino-Americans in California. His production company is Five Card Productions. Gene, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Gene, is it different for Filipino-Americans, or everything you've been hearing from Wesley and Jeffrey makes complete sense to you?
I found that the article was very much on point, and it came for me as a parent of a 13-year-old and 11-year-old boys, that it really affected me very personally, because it reflected a lot of the challenges that I'm going through as a parent, and kind of my, as Jeff was saying, kind of hybrid tiger parenting, and American style parenting. There's a lot of parallels there for the Filipino American community, and for, I think, all Asian communities in some way can relate to the article and what the article is talking about. And so I think that's one of the reasons why the article is so controversial, is because people seem to, if you look at the blogosphere and the people's responses to the article, it's very much about the exception. So, well, I'm an exception to this and I'm an exception to that. And I think a lot of them are not realizing that when they bring up the exceptions, they're bringing up the fact that the article is actually bringing up a lot of really valid points for our communities.
Gene, you said that you have a hybrid style. What part of Tiger did you take out?
Well, the big thing that I've been trying to get both of my sons to understand is that they should always be questioning authority, and they should be looking at the bigger picture. It's not just the memorization of how to multiply fractions or how to, divide, this way or that way, or everything from learning about sex ed to American history. It's about, whenever I go over their homework with them, I get them to try and question what the teacher is trying to teach them, just to make sure that they're looking at all different aspects. And that's, for me, one of the biggest things, is making sure that you're not just assuming that everything you're being taught is, the way it's supposed to be. And the big thing is that, a lot of times this work may seem like it's completely and totally pointless. Like, what is the point of all these different math problems? What is the point of learning what happened in, at the birth of our nation, whatever it might be? And getting them to understand the bigger overall picture, and understanding how to work within the system, so that eventually in the future you can, create new systems or subvert the system and make it better.
Jeffrey, we know that you also have two kids, and in the closing moments of this segment, are you raising them as a tiger dad?
Well, again, I too follow that sort of hybrid style, and, it's interesting. I think that the point about challenging authority or expectation is a very good one. Challenge every authority except mine. I think the thing that I've taken from my own upbringing is that there is a real role for a certain kind of discipline, a certain kind of need to, use work and sweat and perspiration to achieve, and not just assume that things will be handed to you. That's something that my parents certainly tried very hard to teach me. And at the same time, what I've hopefully brought to the process is this sense that, yes, you question, but more, you talk. You have the story.
This is On Point. I'm Deborah Amos, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about Asian Americans and the bamboo ceiling. We have a terrific panel with us today. Wesley Yang is here. His big controversial cover article for last week's New York Magazine was Paper Tigers. Jeffrey Yang is here as well, no relation to Wesley. He's the Asian pop columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. And Gene Kahayan is with us, Filipino-American filmmaker and director of the indie film The Debut. Wesley Yang, I want to talk about, you profile a guy named J.T. Tran, a pickup artist, I'm not altogether sure what that means, and an instructor who trains Asian American men to successfully attract blonde women. Is that a goal? Is that the sort of the benchmark of when your tiger momness is left behind?
I mean, it's his goal.
It's his goal, yes.
The reason I profiled him is that earlier in the piece, I profile a group called LEAP, which is Leadership Education for Asian Pacifics. And what it does is that it takes Asian people in the corporate workplace who feel that they are stuck beneath the bamboo ceiling, and it instructs them in ways to get around it. And it begins with an inquiry into Asian values, and then it looks at the ways that some of those Asian values may, within this particular context in which they're operating, serve as an obstacle to the attainment of what it is they seek, which is advancement within the corporate workplace. So this is about sort of remedial socialization in adulthood, which I think is a fascinating subject because it requires people to take stock of themselves, to say, well, these are my deficiencies or this is what's standing in my way, and here is what I must do to change about either my values or my behavior or skills that I need to acquire in order to become the person that I want to be. And J.T. Tran is a particularly extreme gonzo, brazen person who has decided to sort of incarnate within in himself all the sort of weirdness, tension, contradiction about that collects around Asian American men, and to be completely public about it. So some people have criticized me, including Jeff, for presenting him as an exemplary figure. I don't think he is that at all. I just think he makes great copy. I think the class is an amazing thing to have witnessed and interesting to read about. And I don't think what I'm portraying is not necessarily what I'm advocating, and I think that's a mistake a lot of people made in reading the piece.
But let me ask you this. In both cases, both in Leap that you wrote about and in, Learning to Be a Pickup Artist, it was interesting to me that as an adult, you actually can take stock of yourself and you can learn skills, and you found that there were successful examples in both cases that you can become an executive and you can pick up blondes.
Sure. I mean, I interviewed 8 people that had gone through LEAP training, and including like a woman who speaks with a very heavy accent and managed to become a manager of 20 bank branches in San Francisco. Who knows exactly how it works, but it works. Like, these people went through the training and they got what they were seeking. Asian Playboy, you know, I saw, I think he was a 26-year-old Indian American. A 26-year-old virgin. He had no facial expressiveness. He was actually very handsome. And he ended up being able to open a set. This is the term in pickup artist lingo. Approach a group of strange women at the Hotel Ganzevoort and have a conversation with them for a half hour. That's something that most people wouldn't be able to do, and yet after a weekend of sort of coaching, he was able to do it. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Let's take a call. Richard is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Richard?
Hi.
You're on point.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm the parent, my wife and I are the parents of two Asian children, two adopted children, and it's interesting for me to see the prejudices that are associated with them, in spite of the fact of who their obvious parents are and that they've spent their whole life here. My piano teacher is Korean, and when I was lamenting to her that I couldn't get my kids to practice, so I finally gave up on them, she said, "How come you couldn't get them to practice? They're Asian children," which I thought was a very strange remark. And at the same time, I'm still waiting. I'm wondering if they will do what my family did. My grandfathers were immigrants. But by the time I knew them, they had adopted the whole mantle of American history. My grandfather felt that Lincoln was part of his history because he was a Chicagoan and an Illinoisan, even though he hadn't been in Illinois till, 70 years after Lincoln had died. And I'll take any of your comments off the air.
Let's start with Gene. Do you think that it's more obvious when you have a situation with adopted parents and that they see, in some ways, things that you don't?
Well, that's an interesting point because I have actually a number of friends who have similar situations to that, and that's actually the first time that I've heard of a parent actually even acknowledging the race of their children as a factor. Most of the difficulty that my adopted Asian friends have had growing up in the United States with non-Asian parents has been the fact that their parents just had absolutely no idea what to do about the racism, and so they chose to ignore it and never discuss it. And that actually made the problem even worse. That's like kind of a personal question for me, because I've seen it happen up close and personal to a number of my friends. But yeah, that's, you know, I commend the caller for actually being even cognizant of the issue and trying to make his children's lives better.
And Wesley Yang, is that the subject of a whole other piece, this idea that, you know, that the parents of adopted Asian children have now a whole new experience?
This calls to mind an anecdote that was told to me by a female Asian American psychiatrist who is, she's married to a white guy, and they have a half Asian daughter. I think it's a son. And people will always come up to them and they will ask whether she is, they will assume and they will ask if she is hired help. And they will, even though the child looks half Asian, they never doubt the paternity of the father. So we don't know how much racism there is out there, but racism usually, like, it's not overt hatred, but it's a series of assumptions that people might have about who you are. So I talked to this lawyer who was, he's a poet, he was working at a law firm, and there was a case that was being given to him and two white colleagues. And one of these white colleagues was a math major, in fact, and this person was a poet. But his superior said to him, okay, you're an engineer. So he gives him, like, the most brutally difficult, like, technical-oriented aspect of the piece and gives the easier stuff to the white math major, who is happy to take it because it's much easier. So, like, this is an example of how the bamboo ceiling actually functions, right? These small, like, micro-political entanglements that are to some extent race-oriented, to some extent not race-oriented, and they end up, like, really kind of messing with the morale of a person. And so what my piece opens up with doing is it tries to take a very confrontational stance. And it says, when you look at my face, this is what you think. But it also tries to do something else, which is one of the reasons why many people got upset. It said, it's racism to think that every Asian person fits this mold. But then it also says there's this way that first-generation Asian people are training their children that actually is producing the kind of deficiencies that Amy Chua confessed to experiencing when she was in law school. So you do, in fact, have these people that went through this mill. They get out into the world. They did not learn what they really cared about, felt passionate about, or loved, and thus didn't develop an identity that they could successfully project out into the world. And that's where this kind of stereotype emerges from. And I think what we need to do is, like, call BS on any person that would assume that because somebody is Asian that they fit that mold. But we should also call BS on the cultural practices that also are producing people that fit that mold and that are being renewed by, like, new generations of immigrants. And, of course, like, I understand why they do it. There's a perfect kind of practical sense behind it. But we now have a generation of people who went through this and who've been in the white-collar workplace, and we see the results of it. So we should be learning from it.
Let me reverse this question for Jeffrey Yang. And is it not also that traditional America is afraid of this notion that a tiger mom produces this super smart kid who, they're coming to compete with us and take our jobs? Is there not a bit of fear in the reaction to Wesley Yang?
I think you're absolutely the case. That's the case. I mean, I think the very innovation of the term tiger mom is fascinating because, I mean, almost to circle back to the comic books, it's like a supervillain name, tiger mom, you know? And I think the branding of this particular pattern of immigrant behavior has, in many cases, taken the place of any kind of structural reality, any kind of discourse that might look clearly at what immigrant parents, immigrant Asian parents are doing or not doing and how their kids are faring. And frankly, I mean, there is, of course, that fear built in no small part by the media and media reaction to Amy. Less the book, frankly, than the Wall Street Journal extract that first came out that was actually titled Why Chinese Mothers Are Superior. And there's a similar reaction building towards Wesley's piece, you know, where people are essentially putting a particular typing around the things he says and responding to that as opposed to perhaps looking at the nuances beyond it. I mean, I would actually say that some of the things that Wesley's saying right now, I wish those had made it into the piece. The fact, for instance, that our diversity as a community is huge, is robust. It has we've adopted kids, we've got multiracial kids at a pace actually that is growing faster than any other community. You know, we have more multiracial individuals as a percentage than any other race. And these are things that are complicating the story of Asian Americans. So the notion that we could stamp a single stamp upon that large and diverse context is dangerous, even if you write 9,000 words or 60,000 words or 150,000 words, that those stories should be seen as, you know, single voices in a chorus and not the sole way of looking at this particular community.
Let's take a call from David, who's calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Hi, David.
Hi.
You're on point.
That's a great topic. You know, I'm in total support of the Tiger Mom parenting and, you know, and the Asian culture. And I think out of all the cultures in the world, they have survived and kept a lot of standards and way of life and living that, you know, that create a longevity and long-term sustainability throughout the world where, you know, I think somebody mentioned earlier, there is a lot of fear in the United States. You know, we used to be, very to the grindstone and practiced our education and learned and, you know, and hard-nosed about things. But I think we've become so dramatic and nonsense-driven about, you know, the things that we like and pay attention to nowadays. It's just, I don't know, to me it's just nonsense. I mean, the things that people talk about are not even interesting. It's all about drama and, you know, what's on Idol, you know, American Idol, or, you know, it's all these things that really do not matter in the long term of things. And I think there is a big fear here because it's going to require a lot of parents to change what they feel is important in life.
Wesley Yang, let me ask you about this because...
Not to interrupt here. I do want to remind the caller that he's speaking to a filmmaker and two journalists.
Yes, but he reminds me that there's a term in American parenting called helicopter parents. And as I was preparing for this hour, what was interesting to me is there's plenty of studies that say that the things that Tiger Moms do actually are beneficial for kids. Were you surprised by that, Wesley Yang, when you first started looking into this?
Surprised by what?
That there's science behind what Tiger Moms do.
I didn't really look into the science.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, well, trust me, it's there. And
I mean, if I might, just to the caller's point as well, and as well as to Wesley's talking about JT, the Asian Playboy, earlier, I mean, yes, there is a massive amount of diversity and a lot to be commended about Tiger Mom parenting and the Asian style parenting, however you want to define it. But, you know, myself, I've been working on a film about the pickup community for a couple of years now. And in my research, even though I've never met JT personally, I've met a lot of his contemporaries, a number of whom are Asian American. And of the Asian American pickup artists, and I've met some of the best in the world, the guys who are just like, you know, paid top dollar from students from all over the world. And it does point to a very specific need within, especially amongst Asian American men who went through the Tiger parenting process, and they find themselves woefully inequipped to handle what the caller might describe as frivolous. The ability to actually meet a girl and, you know, go out on a date and have a fun date and actually enjoy yourself. It's something that a lot of Asian American men have not been socialized to be able to do. And therefore you have, when you go to pick up classes, I don't know what Wesley saw in his class, but in the classes that I've seen and I've audited and as part of my research, a very, very high percentage, anywhere from 30 to 50% sometimes, of Asian Americans in the class, Asian American men in the class, trying to fix this problem, being very proactive about trying to fix this deficiency in their life where they're, you know, 30 years old and they've never had a girlfriend, that kind of thing. And so, you know, it's yes, we need to respect the diversity and the fact that the Asian experience is not monolithic, but at the same time, there's very obvious, you know, deficiencies to that style of parenting that will unfortunately lead to a lot of pain in a lot of Asian men's lives particularly.
We've talked a lot about Asian men. Is the experience similar for Asian women? Any of you?
I mean, you know, and of course none of us are in fact women, which is, I think, one of the things that is a bit of a challenge around this discourse, you know, that while the tiger mom position is assigned to or aligned with femininity, where and dads don't really talk about it, aren't spoken about at all, we're the absent forces in that. When you're talking about what Wesley and Gene are speaking here, it's a very, I think, essentialized male perspective. And, you know, here's what I would say. I think that the larger cultural question around whether or not Asian parenting or Asian values encourage things like self-expression, encourage things like risk-taking or confidence, these are things that we do have to think about. But ultimately, we're individuals. We have different stories. And it's sad that these become the only way we're seeing, the only filters we have.
Thanks, all of you. Jeffrey Yang, Asian pop columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and editor of Secret Identities, the Asian American Superhero Anthology. Jeffrey Yang, thanks for being here. Gene Cahayan is a Filipino-American filmmaker and director of The Debut. Gene, great to have you. And Wesley Yang, contributing editor to New York Magazine, author of the cover story Paper Tigers. You can read it on our website, onpointradio.org. Wesley Yang, thank you. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website. I'm Deborah Amos, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.